All right, if you guys have Bibles with you tonight, if you want to open up to 1 Kings chapter 2, if you don't have a Bible and you want one, we've got them in a bookshelf back over there underneath that far blue painting. Feel free to grab one. If you don't own a Bible, man, come talk to me. We will hook you up with a Bible. But if you own a Bible but you forgot it, and you want to read along. But I will tell you, those Bibles back there in that bookshelf, I'm thinking somewhere along the line, we may need to replace those or something. Because have you ever tried to read those things? That is small print. Your eyes are bleeding by the end of it. You're just trying to... Of course, that could just be because I'm old and going blind. But it could be. Giant print. 1 Kings chapter 2. Remember, this is all like one continuous story. We don't know who wrote 1 Kings, 1 and 2 Kings. It's all one book in the original. But obviously it was somebody who has lived through these things, and it's kind of providing the chronology of the various kings who took over Israel after the time of David. And so as we begin here, as we began last week, we saw how... David's son Adoniah had tried to usurp the throne, tried to step in there and take control of the kingdom. He felt like he was the next one in line to be in power. But Nathan the prophet and Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, Solomon, went to David and got him to preemptively make Solomon the king over Israel while David was still alive. And so he stopped that thing from happening. And so we left off where Solomon had decreed that his older brother Adoniah would go ahead and be allowed to live if he proved himself a worthy man, if he was, you know, if he did uprightly. And so Adoniah comes before Solomon and bows down and makes, you know, makes a declaration there by doing so that he sees Solomon as king. And so that's where we left off. So we pick up here now in chapter 2, and let's just begin by reading the first four verses. Now the days of David drew near that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, and walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it's written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do, and wherever you turn, that the Lord may fulfill his word, which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart, and with all their soul, he said, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So David is following the precedent of many leaders. In fact, this goes all the way back from the time when Moses was passing on, and even Abraham passing on the legacy to his sons. And Moses, you know, stood before Israel when he was ready to die and charged them and commanded them about what they should do. And the Lord spoke to Joshua before he passed, to say these same things, that, you know, after Moses had passed away, the Lord spoke to Joshua saying, be strong, be of courage, same kind of words. And so this is sort of a pattern for leadership, especially in the ancient East like this, that they were going to be passing on their final instructions to the one who's going to take their position as king, who was going to take over the throne for them. And so he tells them, you know, be strong. And, you know, that's a common theme, to be strong and to be courageous. That's a common thing that keeps coming up with these leaders, obviously, because, you know, it takes a lot. I mean, it's going to be very challenging and to be a leader among the people of God. That's an important challenge. It's an important challenge for men and women who are going to be leaders in their homes. It's a challenge. We have to be strong. We have to know the strength of the Lord. And that's why, you know, it's important to keep the charge of the Lord. And that's what he says to him, you know, keep the charge of the Lord. Do what he says. Follow his statutes. Just remember him in all of your doings and all of your ways. If we put the Lord first, we put him in all things, we acknowledge him as the leaders, the real leaders of our homes, then the Lord provides the strength that we need to be the leaders and to follow through with the things that he's called us to do. First Chronicles 28 actually gives, and we don't need to turn there, but it will give a more detailed account of the final words that that David gives to Solomon, and he's basically he gives him detailed instruction about making sure that he builds the temple, because that's one of the things that Solomon will be charged to do, to build the temple. And so that's something, if you get a chance, if you want to, you can go over and read that in 1 Chronicles 28. David reminds Solomon of the covenant that God made with him. He was saying, you know, you want to make sure you follow through these things. You want to keep the Lord first and all these things, and the Lord will establish you in your throne, in your kingdom. And he reminds him that the covenant that God made with him said that, you know, if your sons will follow me and follow my ways, then you'll not lack a man sitting on the throne. And of course, we see even there, this covenant that God made with David ends up being conditional. It wasn't unconditional. It wasn't like, you know, no matter what, you're always going to have a guy there, David, because there are a lot of David's descendants who don't, you know, don't do very well and don't follow his ways. And they, and, you know, they don't end up enjoying the benefits of this covenant. They don't do that. But you know, there are those who do. And ultimately, this promise does get fulfilled in the sense that, Jesus is the heir of David, who now rules as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He sits on the throne over the hearts of men in the kingdom of God. And so ultimately, this does get fulfilled through Christ. But David's reminding Solomon that in essence, you know, you want to put God first in everything. Seek God first, and then he'll take care of all the rest of it. He'll add everything else to you in your kingdom. And of course, that's something that Jesus almost reiterates in Matthew chapter 6 when he says, seek first the kingdom of God, and all of these things will be added to you. This is cool, because the charge that David is giving to Solomon was to put him on the right path. And it wasn't, you know, make sure that, you know, his first instructions, now he'll get to this stuff, but his first instructions were not to Solomon saying, man, go out there and get everybody who's arrayed against you. Take care of business, get everything in order, and, seize control and make sure that you establish your base of power and get everybody on your side and all these different political things. He doesn't teach him political stuff at all, but he actually points towards the thing that's the most important. He says, you know, follow the Lord. Commit your ways to him. Follow his ways and keep his commandments. And all of these things then are going to be taken care of. And that's so true in every aspect of life. That's why Jesus says that. You know, we spend our lives running around trying to, you know, secure not only a sense of security for ourselves, but oftentimes we're working, trying to create a sense of security for our kids. And there's nothing wrong with that. We want to put back for our kids and do those sorts of things. But those are not the most important things. The most important thing is to follow the Lord and walk according to his covenant ways. Psalm 103. He makes everything all right for you and your children as you follow his covenant ways and remember to do as he says. And so that's the most important thing. Seek the Lord first, and then he will take care of this. That's not saying that he's going to make us rich or anything like that, but he will provide for what we need. He will take care of us as we walk through this life as we keep him first. All right, verse 5. Moreover, this is David still talking. Moreover, you know also that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, what he did to me and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Yatir, whom he killed. And he shed the blood of war in peacetime and put the blood of war on his belt that was around his waist and on his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore, do according to your wisdom. Do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. But show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among you who eat at your table, so that they came so they came to me when I fled from Absalom your brother. And see that you have with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, from Bakurim, who cursed me with a malicious curse in the day when I went to Mahanaim. But he came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now, therefore, do not hold him guiltless, for you're a wise man, and you know what you ought to do to him. But bring his gray hair down to the grave with blood. Okay, we get the Lord stuff out of the way. Now, I want you to deal with these people. He speaks to him about what he's doing here. He's talking to Solomon, and he's wanting to establish in Solomon a sense of justice. He wants his reign to be with justice. And so these are, in essence, kind of like loose ends that David has left there. Part of it is because these are things that he's sworn, you know, he's promised and made a vow about, so that he's kind of tied his own hands and he's going to honor his vow. But some of it has to do with, we're not exactly sure what it has to do. You know, when we look at this, the first person that he's talking about bringing to justice is Joab. Now, Joab is probably one of the most complex contradictory characters of the Old Testament, because he was the commander of David's army. I mean, he was with David from way back when David was on the run with his band of merry men out in the wilderness, when he's running from Saul. The moment he comes back to take a position of power, man, Joab is right there with them. And I mean, he's through thick and through thin, and they fight battles together and they do all these things. And there are times when we're looking at Joab and we're thinking, wow, this guy's a really cool guy. He's a mighty warrior and he's loyal to David. But yet we see all through this other side of Joab, where even though he seems like he's loyal to David, man, he'll be disobedient to David's commands at the drop of a hat if it's going to advance his own cause in various things. So we begin to assume then that the loyalty that he was displaying was more born out of nationalism than any kind of loyalty to David or loyalty to the Lord. And so what David is saying, you know, he's waiting, you know, here till the end of his own life, but he's saying, you've got to deal with this. You've got to deal with specifically two murders that Joab carried out. He murdered two men. One of them, he murdered Abner, son of Ner, who had killed his brother during a battle back when they were first trying to establish who was going to be king over Israel. And so, you know, that was kind of like the Avenger of Blood type thing. He murdered him in cold blood, you know, pulled him out into an alley and stabbed him. And then Amasai was the same kind of thing. He snuck up with a sword, went up to pretend like he was going to kiss him, you know, that would have tipped me off right away. But either way, that Amasai is somebody that David had put in control of the army in Joab's place after the Absalom thing. And so he went up to him, you know, to greet him and stuff, and he had a sword hidden, and he stabbed him right there in cold blood. And David makes this indication here. He's saying he shed the blood of wartime during peace. In other words, this was cold-blooded murder. There was no reason for this. This was not provoked in the right sense. This wasn't something that was carried out in the heat of a battle as they were trying to establish control of a territory or something like that. This was just Joab doing Joab's thing and it was wrong. Now you wonder about this. You think, well, why did David wait till now to deal with this? I mean, why is he waiting till now to bring justice in this? Why is he passing it on to his son? You know, I wasn't going to take care of him. You take care of him. And you know, obviously Joab is old because he talks about his gray hair, so he's an old man too. And we don't know. Actually, the text doesn't really indicate to us why he would have waited like this. It could be because it's his nephew, it's his sister, it's Uriah, it's his sister, it's his sister's son. So it could be because it's a familial thing. You know, he's got to see his sister at all the family reunions, and, you know, it's no fun. I killed your son. I'm sorry about that. So it could very well be that he just didn't want to do that because of the closeness there, and Solomon being one more removed was going to be able to deal with it a little easier. It's just hard to say. I don't know. Maybe he was trying to honor the fact that Joab did fight with him all those years. You know, they stood in battle together for all those years, and there's a bond that develops there. That's true all through history, the bond that develops between soldiers. It could just very well be that he couldn't get past that. He couldn't bring himself to do that to Joab, but he knew that justice had to be served in this. So, you know, either way, it's hard to tell. There's no way of knowing, but now, obviously, as he's telling Solomon here, it's time to pay the piper. He's going to have to pay for this. And then he tells Solomon to show kindness to Barzillai, and he's someone who had, when David was on the run, when Absalom, his son, had seized control, and if you remember all of this from 2 Samuel, he had seized control and taken over Jerusalem, and David and all of his entourage had to go on the run. And when they went to Bakurim, this was a man who showed him kindness, took him in, took care of him, fed his army, and all of these kinds of things. And so David wanted to replay that kindness, and so he tells him, you know, give his sons a place at the table, which is basically saying, bring him into the royal family. I mean, he's not going to be an official part of the family, but he will enjoy, his sons will enjoy all the benefits of being part of the royal household. That means, you know, that's what it's all the stuff of David's family and Solomon's family is going to be available to these guys because of the kindness that they showed him there. And David is determined he's going to show that kindness in return. But then there was another character from that same time period by the name of Shimei. And if you remember the story, as David was going towards Bakurim and he had all of his army with him, this guy Shimei all of a sudden jumps out there and is standing over by a cliff and he starts pelting these guys with rocks, you know, these well-armed guys with rocks. So, you know, clearly he's, but either way, he's kicking dust and he's yelling at him and he's cursing David and calling him all these names, saying, I can hardly wait till Absalom gets here and you're toast and you're done with, and that's what you get for, because he was part of Saul's household. So that's what you get for coming in and taking over the kingdom. Well, when, of course, Absalom was killed and everybody was in a rout, Shimei realized right away that he was going to be in huge trouble. So he was the first one to meet David as he got back to the Jordan River. He bowed down before him to acknowledge that, you know, he had done wrong. And so David swore to him at that time, I'm not going to kill you. You know, I'm not, you know, everybody was saying, we should go ahead and kill him. And he said, no, I'm not going to kill him. We're not going to kill anybody today. We've done enough killing. Let's just, you know, let's be nice to him. And so he made a vow saying that he wasn't going to kill him or anything. But now he comes up again, which is a curious thing, you know. And honestly, nobody's got a sufficient answer for this, for me anyway. I mean, the only thing that we can maybe kind of figure is maybe somewhere along the way, because he is still part of Saul's household, that fallen household, maybe he was still being cantankerous to some degree. Maybe he was still creating mischief. It's hard to say, you know. Maybe he was being obnoxious. Maybe he was still throwing stones. I don't know. Either way, David is requiring that justice be served to him, even though David had vowed not to kill him himself. He's passing that on to his son, saying, you're a pretty smart kid. You're going to figure out what to do. But, you know, even though he says, you're a smart kid, you'll figure out what to do, he says, but make sure that his gray hair doesn't go down without blood. So, okay, gotcha, Dad. So anyway, that's, you know, it could very well be, and this is probably the best, the most satisfactory answer to me, that David is looking at these various men, these various people. He knows there are some people who are going to be a great benefit to Solomon as he's a young man beginning this reign as a king, and there are some people who are going to be a problem. Joab is one of them who's going to be a problem. This guy Shimei is still there and must be presenting some sort of problem. And so he's looking at the various assets and the various detriments to this future kingdom, and he's trying to instruct his son to take care of these things, to weed these things out, and so that he can be established early on in his rule as king. That's about the best we can come up with on that. So okay, so it goes on, verse 10. So David rested with his fathers, and that doesn't mean that he, you know, was taking a nap. It means he died. David rested with his fathers, and he was buried in the city of David. So he's buried in Jerusalem. The period that David reigned over Israel was 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. Then Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his kingdom was firmly established. So this ends the story of David. Here's where his story comes to a conclusion. We've been with him for a long time. We've gone through a lot of different adventures with him. We were there with him when he was just a young kid, walking out with nothing but faith and a handful of stones to face a giant. And we've been with him on the run in the wilderness as Saul in his madness was trying to destroy him. We've been with him through his times of exile when he was hanging out with the Philistines and almost forgetting his heritage. We've been with him when he became king and became the ruler over Israel, a man after God's own heart, the ruler that every person loved. We've been with him through all the highs and the lows, the times when he failed the Lord and fell into sin, and the times when he was restored by God, and the troubles that came to his life as a result of that. But in all of that, his heart was always towards God, and his heart was always soft towards his father. And now he comes to an end like anybody will come to an end. You know, that's the Psalms tell us to teach us to number our days so that we can apply our hearts to wisdom. David lived a good long life. He lived more than a lot of people live in a lifetime. And he was an amazing king, and God blessed him, and he experienced amazing things. And yet, when his time was complete, he went the way that everybody goes, and he passes away on the scene. Now, it says there that he's buried in Jerusalem, and it appears as though the whereabouts of that tomb was known for a long period of time. Acts chapter 2 mentions this tomb. Early Christian writers, Jerome, 300 years after Acts, mentions the tomb of David as though it's a place where they're familiar with and they know it. But since the fall of Jerusalem and the Dark Ages, that knowledge has been lost to us. There's a location in Jerusalem that they point to as being the site of David's tomb, but most scholars dismiss that as spurious. And that's one of those strange things. Things that get, you know, we live in the United States in an age of sophistication and such a stage of advancement in our knowledge about so many things that we have a tendency to think that, yeah, we got everything figured out, we got it all wrapped up, we understand everything. And yet, really, there's so much that we don't know, and especially as it touches history, so much that's unknown to us and that's mysterious to us. And most of what we know about the ancient world still gets filtered through the strangeness of the Dark Ages. So it's hard to know exactly when we lost that information. More than likely, though, it was the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. But for a long time, people knew where his tomb was. It's even said that King Herod had robbed many of the articles out of that tomb. And so in order to cover that up, he started making a greater monument there. And I don't know, it's an interesting... It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. I don't know how I got on that subject. Let's go on here. Verse 13. Now Adoniah, the son of Haggit, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon. So she said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably." Moreover, he said, "I have something to say to you." And she said, "Say it." And he said, "You know that the kingdom was mine, and all Israel had set their expectations on me, that I should reign. However, the kingdom is turned over and has become my brother's, for it was from the Lord, I guess. Now, I ask one petition of you, and don't deny me." And she said to him, "Say it." Then he said, "Please speak to King Solomon, for he will not refuse you, that he may give me Abishag, the Shunammite, as a wife." So Bathsheba said, "Very well, I'll speak to the king. I'll speak for you to the king." Okay, it's obvious that nobody really trusts Adoniah anymore. I mean, obviously, you know, he tried to usurp the kingdom. And even Bathsheba, when he's coming to visit, you know, it's doon, doon, and she's looking through the peephole, and she's saying, you know, "Do you come in peace?" And he's saying, "Yeah, of course I do." But she doesn't trust him. I mean, clearly, the very fact that she's talking this way is an indicator that she doesn't trust him. She does, you know, she's suspicious of what he's there for and what this is all about. And he launches in. So he comes in, sits down in the parlor with her, and he launches into his delusions about, you know, what he believed his state was before Solomon was made king. You know, he goes in, you know, that I was supposed to be king, and that all of Israel was, you know, had their expectation, you know, making it look like he had this huge following, and that all of Israel, but now, you know, but we know that it really wasn't like that. I mean, he had a few of David's supporters. Joab had gone with him, Abiathar, the high priest, had gone with him, and we know that he had a dinner party full of people, but that's about the extent of it, you know. So a dinner party and a priest and sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. But either way, so it wasn't like all of Israel was expecting this. And we know that because as soon as Solomon had been declared king in chapter 1, remember the whole place went erupted in joy and happiness, and the flutes were playing and the dancing and the screaming, and they could hear it at the dinner party. And as soon as the people found out that Solomon was king at the dinner party, remember, they just scrammed out of there immediately. So it wasn't like he had that great of a following, but in his mind, clearly he did. And you can see very easily his sense of injustice in this. He feels like he's been, even though he makes it clear that it was the Lord's doing. Yeah, well, the Lord gave it to him. You know, it was a big mistake, as far as I can tell, but he gave it to him anyway. And so he asks Bathsheba to ask Solomon on his behalf for Abishag, the Shunammite woman, as a wife. Now, remember who Abishag is. This is the girl, remember, that as we began 1 Kings, it said David was really old, and he was so old that he couldn't get any heat. You know, nobody wasn't able to, his body temperature had just plummeted, and he couldn't maintain the right body temperature. And so they figured, the only thing that made sense to them, I guess, was that, well, we need a pretty girl in here with him, and that'll help warm him up. And so that's who this is. Abishag comes in there, and she's going to wait on him. More than likely, we make the assumption, more than likely, she has become his concubine. So remember, a concubine is kind of like a spare wife. I don't know how to word that, but you know, it's not an official wife, but it's a legally binding thing, and And remember, you know, obviously, I don't want to have to keep making this speech over and over and over again, but, you know, it was the revelation of the gospel in the New Testament that gave us the understanding that the ground is level at the foot of the cross, and that was the seeds of the understanding of the equality within the sexes. But at that time and within the cultural influences of that time, you know, women were not viewed that way. They weren't viewed as equals. Even though the seeds of that are there in the old covenant, God still made those allowances, and because of the hardness of their hearts, you know, allowed for them to treat people this way. And so women didn't have those kinds of rights. They were considered more like property. So, you know, as bad as it sounds, that's what a concubine would have been. She would have been part of David's property. And we've talked about this before, that you know, this was a major thing for a man to take over the concubine of another man who was a person of power. You know, we saw this all the way back with Isaac and his sons, and it's, you know, it's a power play. If a man is going to go in and take the concubine of the former king, that's a power play. That's a means by which he is going to be asserting a claim on the throne. So it's not just that, you know, she was really pretty and you was thinking, well, she's available now and, you know, I need a wife or something like that. It wasn't anything like that. This is a calculated move for him to go ahead and do another sort of treacherous means by which he can take the throne. And you wonder, you know, everybody would have known. You'd think everybody would know that. So it kind of informs us a little bit. We realize then Bathsheba has the ear of Solomon, and clearly she was not a political player. She must not have been, because if she'd had the kind of savvy that you would expect, I don't think he would have gone to her. So he must have seen her as being naive. And Solomon at this time must be very young. And so he's thinking that Solomon would be naive enough to maybe go along with this and think this is okay. So maybe I can pull this over on these people. That's the only thing that we can figure in this. You know, he's going to go to her and ask her to ask Solomon. And he knows that, you know, he's a mama's boy, so he's definitely going to not, you know, say no to her. So this was just nothing less than an underhanded attempt at him trying to take the throne once again trying to assert his power. So, you know, if he were to marry David's concubine, then that would give him the leverage that he needed to try to assert himself as king. Okay, verse 19. Bathsheba, therefore, went to King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah. And the king rose up to meet her and bowed down to her and sat down on his throne and had a throne set for the king's mother. So she sat at his right hand. And she said, I desire one small petition of you. Do not refuse me. And the king said to her, ask it, my mom, for I will not refuse you. So she said, let Abishag, the Shunammite, be given to Adonijah, your brother's wife. Okay, so, you know, why would she even agree? You know, we can't think that she really was this naive. Why did she agree to this? Why would she agree to go to Solomon with this request? Why didn't she just say, no, you know, you're out of your mind. Get out of my house. You're crazy. You're trying to take over my son's kingdom. Clearly, she saw through it, but, I mean, well, this is the way I'm putting it together, and you can disagree with me if you want. I believe she saw through it. I believe she recognized right away what was going on here, and I believe that she was going along with it so that she could go to Solomon to make it very clear what Adonijah was up to. And so she comes and she presents that. I could be wrong. The text isn't saying that. I'm reading that into it. But she wants Solomon to know exactly what he's got going on. She says, I got a small request. Well, it's not a small request. There's nothing small about that. So it could very well be that this is even sarcasm that she's using. I just got a little thing that I want to talk to you about. And, you know, and then she drops this bombshell of what it is that he's asking for. So what's going to happen? Is Solomon smart enough to know what to do here? Okay, verse 21. So she said, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother, as a wife. Verse 22, and King Solomon answered and said to his mother, now why don't you ask Abishag the Shunammite why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he's my older brother, for him and for Abiathar the priest and for Joab, the son of Zadok. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, may God do so to me and more also, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has confirmed me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who has established a house for me as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today. So King Solomon sent by the hand of Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down, and he died. Okay, well, that was a bad plan. Solomon, even though he's young, perfectly understands the situation, perfectly sees what's implied with this. And so, he doesn't even have to hear that Adoniah had come to his mom. He immediately ties him to this. He says, well, Adoniah has asked you to do this, then this guy is out to do no good. Remember, that's where we left off in the last chapter. Solomon had said, look, I'll let him live if he proves himself a worthy man. But if he's not, if his iniquity is found in him, then he'll be put to death. And the idea behind that is if he'll support me, if he'll be good in this and be a support and a benefit to the kingdom, then he's going to be okay. But if not, I'm going to get rid of him. And so, he was spared initially. He submitted to God's decision and Solomon's rule, at least outwardly, but inwardly he had this treachery still at work. And so he shows that he was still out to get his own way. So Solomon has Benaiah, the former mighty man of David, to dispatch him immediately. It's all fun and games until somebody gets run through. And so that's what's happening here. So that's the end of him. That's no more treachery from his older brother. That's the end of his story right there. Just a few conniving attempts, and he's met with a dead end, quite literally. Verse 26. And so Abiathar the priest... And to Abiathar the priest, the king said, go to Anathoth, your own fields, for you are deserving of death, but I will not put you to death at this time because you carried the ark of the Lord God before my father David, and because you were afflicted every time my father was afflicted. So Solomon removed Abiathar from being priest of the Lord to the Lord, that he might fulfill the word of the Lord which he had spoke concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. So, Abiathar, the high priest, had allied himself with Adoniah. So, this is all this political intrigue. That's just this kind of soap opera-esque or crime thriller-esque or whatever. I mean, it's a political story here. And Solomon strips him of his power and exiles him. He doesn't put him to death. And he gives those reasons. You were afflicted with my father. You were going through all these things. You carried the ark of the Lord. So clearly he's saying, it's not because you're worthy. It's not because you're such a great guy. I can't, do without you. It's for the Lord's sake and for my father's sake, I'm going to let you live. And so he shows mercy to him, and he doesn't execute him, but he exiles him to his hometown. He has to leave Jerusalem. And this exile, it says there, fulfills the word of prophecy made against Eli. That's back in 1 Samuel 2. God was going to remove all of Eli's descendants from the altar. Chapter 2, verses, I think, 30 to 34, it's in there somewhere. And so, Solomon, it's interesting because it doesn't seem to indicate that Solomon was waiting for this moment to go ahead and fulfill that for the Lord. This will work perfectly because the Lord said he was going to do this. Solomon is doing, his own heart's intent here. I don't want to kill this guy, but I'm going to exile him, and he's not going to be, he strips him of his power as high priest. He's not going to be a priest before the altar anymore. And it was for the obvious reasons that were going on there. He had committed treachery against the king at that time. And yet it ends up fulfilling. And that's just an amazing thing, because this was, a prophecy given years and years and years before Solomon's time. It wasn't like Solomon was out there trying to figure out how he's going to make this thing come to pass. When it comes to the prophecies that the Lord makes, when it comes to all the things that he's got set in order, we don't have to wring our hands or try to figure out how it's going to happen or how we're going to work to make it come to pass or anything like that. The Lord is going to fulfill the Lord's word. And when it comes to the end times and things that, one of the things that fascinates me is how wigged out we'll get over different things as it pertains to eschatology, as it pertains to the issues of the end times. Christians will look at all the different, some strains of Christians will do this. I used to be on newsletter things when I used to be one of those guys. And you'd get these newsletters from people who were trying to explain to you about the Illuminati and how Exxon and everybody was involved in all these different conspiracies that were working towards, supporting the Antichrist and establishing his rule. And all of a sudden it dawned on me one day, I thought, well, wait a minute, what is the point of all these things? I mean, am I going to boycott Exxon and that's going to keep the Antichrist from coming? I mean, is that the idea behind this, or what are we doing here? Let's just let God fulfill what he's going to fulfill. We'll play our part in it, and we won't even know we're playing our part in it. We're just going to go on and obey the Lord and follow his ways, just like Solomon was doing. Solomon was just following the Lord and doing what he knew was going to be right, and in doing so, he fulfills a prophecy that was made by someone else a long time ago, and it all fits perfectly, because that's the cool thing about God. He's sovereign. sovereign. He's in complete and total control, and he does that somehow, amazingly, in the midst of all of our own free will choices. And all the things that we determine we're going to do, both good and bad, God weaves his plan and purpose through it all, which makes him cool to me. But either way. So where did I leave off? Does anybody know? Where? I left off in verse 28? Well, that's why. I got a lot more notes here. Did I say everything? Okay, it doesn't matter. Verse 28, then. Then news came to Joab, for Joab had defected to Adoniah, though he had not defected to Absalom. You know, when Absalom tried to make a bid for power, Joab stayed true to David. But for some reason, he did. He defected here. And so, you know, he knows he's in trouble. So Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. King Solomon was told, hey, Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord. And there he is by the altar. And then Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go strike him down. And so Benaiah went to the tabernacle of the Lord, and he said to him, thus says the king, come out. And he said, no, but I'll die here. And Benaiah brought back the word to the king, saying, thus says Joab, and thus he answered me. And the king said to him, do as he says. Strike him down, bury him, that you may take him away from me and from the house of my father, the innocent blood which Joab shed. And so the Lord will return his blood on his head because he struck down two men more righteous and better than he, and he killed him with a sword. Abner, the son of Ner, and the commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, the son of Jether, the commander of the army of Judah, though my father David didn't know it. Their blood shall therefore return upon the head of Joab and upon the head of the descendant of his descendants forever. But upon David and his descendants, upon the house of his throne, there shall be peace forever from the Lord. So Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and struck and killed him, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. The king put Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, in his place over the army, and the king put Zadok, the priest, in place of Abiathar. Okay, so Joab knew what was coming here. You know, he sees everything coming down. He realizes everybody's getting taken out, and his other ally, Abiathar, has been exiled, so he's got no place. And so he does exactly what Jehoiada had done. He runs into the tabernacle. He grabs hold of the horns of the altar. The altar had four different, they called them horns. They were pointed ends that came on the corners of the altar. And even though God didn't say this directly in his word, this became some sort of traditional thing, kind of like religious sanctuary, you know, run into the church and claim sanctuary and nobody's going to bother you there. So he saw that this had worked, obviously, with Jehoiada. You know, well, he went in there, or not with Jehoiada, but Adoniah. He went in there and grabbed a hold of the horns of the altar and was, you know, spared because of it. And so I'm going to try this too. This works. This is great. Good stuff. So he runs in there and he grabs a hold of the horns of the altar. The only problem is that in Exodus chapter 21, verse 14, it makes it very clear that if a person is guilty of murder, of premeditated murder, which Joab was, then God makes an allowance, says go in and remove him from the altar and you know, destroy him. So, you know, even though it wasn't clearly saying that you could grab hold of the horns and get sanctuary, there must have been some anticipation of this, but God is saying, but if he's really clearly guilty, you know, that's not gonna protect him. So, you know, it's one of those things. It's kind of a picture, though, of many people when all of a sudden they recognize and realize that they're not right with the king, when they suddenly come to the realization that they're on the wrong side or the losing side of something. Instead of coming and falling down and crying out for mercy and submitting their hearts to the rule and the way of the king, crying out for mercy directly, they'll run and get religious. They'll run and take a hold of the horns of the altar. They'll run and get involved in as many religious things as they possibly can in order to try to claim some sort of sanctuary. Well, you know, God's not going to clearly be unhappy with me if I'm doing all these good things, if I'm running around trying to do as many religious things as possible. I mean, I'm vacuuming the church. I'm helping old ladies across the street. I'm doing all these different things. Surely God is going to be okay with me. But see, there's a picture in this, you know, that's not it. Being religious and getting ourselves associated with something religious is not going to be the means by which we're going to find amnesty with God. It's only as we fall before him directly, call for his mercy, and submit ourselves to his rule. That's the thing that's going to do it. That's why, you know, we want to be so careful even how we're presenting the gospel. We don't want to wrap the gospel around all these various works or different things. You know, we don't want to ever send the message to people that makes it seem as though, well, if you'll just come to church, you know, you should come to church with me. It's all right. Invite people to church who don't know the Lord. That's fine. We want them here to explore and hear for themselves. But let's not ever turn that into something where we make it appear as though, well, if you come to church, everything will be okay. You know, come on over to church and everything will be spiffy. That's not the answer. Coming and hanging out with Christians, coming and holding onto the horns of the altar is not going to be the means by which our guilt is expunged. Ours is blood guilt. Ours is the guilt of the blood of Christ. And yet that's the very blood that covers us when we submit to him and forgives us and atones for our sins. And so, you know, just religious behavior is not going to satisfy that sort of thing. All right, let's finish this up here. Verse 36. Then the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and dwell there. And don't go out from there anywhere. For it shall be on the day that you go out across the brook Kidron, know for certain, you shall surely die. Your blood shall be upon your own head. And Shimei said to the king, the saying's good. As the Lord the king has said, so your servant will do. So Shimei dwelt in Jerusalem many days. Now it happened at the end of 3 years, the two slaves of Shimei ran away to Achish, the son of Maakah, the king of Gath. And they told Shimei, saying, look, your slaves are in Gath. So Shimei arose, saddled his donkey, and went to Achish at Gath to seek his slaves. And Shimei went and brought the slaves from Gath. And Solomon was told that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and had come back. And the king sent and called for Shimei, and he said, didn't I make you swear by the Lord and warn you, saying, know for certain on the day that you go out and travel anywhere that you'll surely die? And you said to me, the word I've heard is good. Why then have you not kept the oath of the Lord and the commandment that I gave you? And the king said moreover to Shimei, you know, as your heart acknowledges all the wickedness that you did to my father David, therefore the Lord will return your wickedness on your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. Thus the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. So, you know, here's Shimei. You know, it starts off okay. He puts him under house arrest. He's saying, you know, I'm not gonna kill you. He's really giving him a chance. I mean, by all rights, even way back there, he could have been put to death easily for his act of insolence towards the king. It was an act of treason. But he was, you know, he was shown mercy. God, or David, determined that he wasn't going to kill him. And so he got away with it. And then when he's brought before Solomon, you know, again, I'm sure when he came before Solomon, this is why it sounds good to him, he was expecting he was going to be put to death. He's still from the household of Saul. You know, there's still it would certainly well be within the rights of the king to go ahead and destroy those who might present themselves as a problem later on. But Solomon extends mercy and he says, I'm not going to kill you, man. You just stay here, though. You stay, you know, where I can see you. And don't leave here. And he says, right, you got it, man. I love it here. This is great. There's theaters, everything I need. There's a handy mall down the way. They're putting Walmart in. I'm perfect. I don't need anything else. I will stay right here. You got it. But then later on down the line, you know, some of his property, something that belongs to him, it's, you know, it's slaves, it's human beings, but he's, you know, clearly a man of wealth, a man of position, and clearly someone who's not willing to let go of anything that had belonged to him. He determines that, well, I'm going to go get these slaves back. I'm not going to let these guys get away from me. I'm not going to let something that belongs to me slip away from my hands. You know, there's an indicator of what's going on in his heart. There's a claim and an ownership. And this claim to ownership, even as over something as precious as a human life, how strange is that, that he would do something like that? You know, some have said that this seems kind of harsh because, you know, this was just an oversight. He merely forgot. But, you know, how do you forget something like that? I mean, you know, you're told very clearly, don't leave here or you die. That's simple. That's easy. You could actually make that in one of those little, you know, those little things you sew and put on the wall, you know, like bless this mess or whatever, you know, don't leave or die. It seems a little bit ridiculous that he would have forgotten that somehow. That's a serious charge, and it's only been 3 years. I forget all kinds of stuff, but I don't forget things like that. That's important stuff, and so it doesn't appear that this is oversight. It doesn't appear anything else except that over time, he's developed a certain insolence. He's all of a sudden developed a sense that, you know what, I can do what I want. This king's not going to do anything to me. I can get my own way. I can follow my own will. I can do as I please. I will go take what is mine and I'll bring it back, and no one will be the wiser, and I can do what I want. But clearly, Solomon finds out. And so he ends up being executed for this. You know, so it's, the law is the law when it comes to that. There's another reason why I'm in no way interested in putting myself under the old covenant law, because the law is the law. And the fact of the matter is it doesn't matter for what reason, for what other kind of great excuse we may come up with. If we violate the law, then we're condemned by the very law that we violate. And the law was here. The law was in place. Mankind was condemned by sin. You know, it's not our place as Christians to run around and go out and try to condemn anybody. Everybody's already condemned. The law has done its work. All mankind is condemned because we couldn't keep the law. That's why we want to always establish ourselves on the mercy and the grace of God, not the laws of God. We want to fall back on on the mercy that he reveals and the grace that's provided to us through the death, the atoning blood of Jesus Christ. Let that be the thing on which our lives are established, not the law, because the law is black and white. The law is life and death, and that is it. And if you can't comply, then you're done with. And there's a great example of it. Now, verse 46 ends with Solomon being established. So he starts quite differently from Saul or David, his father, who both had to fight quite a bit and struggle with their surrounding, you know, the Philistines and all the various nations that were around them. Solomon steps into a turnkey operation here. I mean, he walks in, and once he quells a few little things that were internal, I mean, he steps in and his kingdom is established. This is different from anybody else now. You know, he's coming in to a position where his borders are secure. His power is increased already, and so it'll be interesting to see what he does with this kind of power. So, Father, we just thank you for your word, and we thank you for this story and all the various ways in which we can see your truth in it and the various ways in which we're able to apply it to our own lives. So continue to lead us and guide us in this story as we fulfill our part of it through our lives. And we ask you to do this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.